Welcome to Spirals, an effort in preventing trauma by talking about difficult topics. The content may be triggering. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to spirals@unicornvoice.com. After this episode, you may hear one of Tanya's original songs or weird demos. This is part two of talking to my brother, and we're digging right into talking about pedophiles. Did you get to say any questions to me?
Yes, I had one question about what is actually a pedophile.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's I think that's interesting because I mean it's if we know why people have this state of mind,
yeah,
then we maybe can do something about it.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm not sure if it's possible to do anything
about it.
I don't know either,
but it's worth exploring, right?
So you could take their sexual... Would that help if you remove their sexual needs?
So there's a drug that... there's a professor in Sweden at Karolinska that I'm talking to, and he says that there is a drug that's newly developed that could, you know, stagger their sexual drive. But there's been some experience before. I'll have more information later on how this works. But the way I look at it, a pedophile is a person with sexual thoughts of children. Now there's a new term called MAP. It is a minor attracted person, which is a better word because the pedophile word is being used as an abuser, even by news outlets. They're using this word as the person is an abuser and a molester. But there is a whole society, or not society, there's a whole community of people who have sexual thoughts of children that have vowed to never touch or harm a child and to never see SAM, child abuse material, online.
That's a very good point, because I think if you look at child porn, then you're an abuser.
You're part of it.
Yeah,
yes.
You're part of it. You're a huge part of the problem.
So there's programs now all over Europe, especially a really good one in Sweden, and I know there's a big one in Germany, that is working on preventative measures. So my goal of even diving or trying to dare to duck, this is a scary project because, you know, some people don't hear that you're trying to work of preventing child abuse. They only hear, oh, you're a pedophile lover. You're trying to make the world better for a pedophile. So I always try to think, where do we, like with our dad, I really believe that if he got help when he was 14, 15 years old in school or even younger, and some of the stuff that he was going through was normalized, they were talking about it, there was a place to call, there were people who could catch him, then our lives, we probably wouldn't exist. That's the number one. But
that's number one, yeah. But the kids who would have existed would probably have a better life.
Probably. Yeah. I really believe that the prevention, and, you know, back again to how much money it's costing society. I mean, not prevention, but trauma. When somebody, I don't remember now, but it's like the GDP, is that the word?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's a the last study that I read last year was from 2.5% to about 5% of any country's GDP is where every country is when it comes to trauma, healing trauma. So in Norway,
all kinds of trauma, or
violence and abuse, or domestic abuse, or something.
No, but that sounds
that's high number.
So I don't think that's a high number.
No, but I mean it's a high number in money. So if we can spend some of that money trying to work on prevention measures, then we could really get somewhere. When it comes in the other end, we wouldn't have that cost of treating.
I think those numbers sound way too low. 2.5 to 5% of GDP, that's where, I mean, with everything I know about all the people I've met and all the stories we read every day, and that this is actually my next question for you.
Can I just say, I think you misunderstood. This is not the number of people.
No, the number of money.
This is number of money that we're spending.
It's going
treating.
To cost us. Yeah.
It's going to cost us more and more people start coming out, sharing their stories and needing help. Because I think we are the first generation that is coming out and asking for help like our mom's generation, this is, we talked about this before. I have told my mom everything, how mad I am about my childhood, because I really think it's important to place the blame. First, I place the blame on my mom and my dad. It's their fault that this happened. It's not my fault. It was never my fault. That made a huge change in my life. And when I move past the fault, here comes responsibility. Now, whose responsibility is it to do something? Well, I'm an adult. It's my responsibility. I have to work on it. But if society can help me, it's going to go faster. And if they could help me when I was a child, of course, I would go way faster. Are you agreeing?
I agree. Yeah. Absolutely.
So when it comes to spending money on prevention, I think there's going to be a lot less money to prevent trauma from happening than it's going to cost us trying to fix it after the fact.
That is, I agree.
So when I
think.
Yeah, but we don't know this, right? There's no way of knowing. But
because, and this is why my next question to you is, as we speak, there is a trial going on in Kristiansand with these serious, I mean, they're not just pedophile molesters, but they're also killers.
Yeah.
They actually raped and killed two small kids, 9 or 10 years old, 20 some years back. And one of them has actually been
acquitted.
I mean, he was acquitted.
Yeah, 20 years later after
and
serving.
And still today, the other one, which is now in court because they need to try to end the story and find out who killed the second child.
Yeah.
And he still claims that the second person was there. This is very difficult.
Yeah.
But my point with the question here is that when I read about this in the paper every day.
Yeah.
And it's in the papers. It's on the news. I mean, this is a big part of the news picture.
Yeah.
For a long time. And it makes me extremely angry.
Yeah.
Does it make you angry?
It does. And I think it makes people in general angry. And that's why most people just say we should kill every person who has an affliction, you know, towards sexual thoughts of children. But if you drag that thought out, what kind of society are we building if as soon as someone knows that they have sexual thoughts of children, maybe they're like 14, 15 years old. A lot of the people I've talked to are that age. Imagine, you know, instinctively right away, you cannot speak to your mother, your father, your teacher, your doctor, your therapist. You have nobody. You're alone. So what do? There's no place for you to go. Today there is, though, but it's very little information about it still.
But do these people have anywhere to go?
They go
do they
to
have
the dark
to talk to?
Web. And who's on dark
no,
web?
No, I mean,
and
do
darknet?
They have anyone they can talk to?
Not
about
really.
Their things,
so
no?
That's what I'm saying.
That is crazy.
If you go to darknet, who's on darknet? The hardened freaking criminals that are already way past any kind of help, probably. What do I know? But they're already been doing CSAM or watching abuse material or even creating abuse material online for years. They're seasoned in grooming children. They are the ones that you meet. The first people you meet are on the dark web or darknet. And these are the people that are going to guide you. So that's why there are groups now of like this VerPed, Virtuous Pedophiles, that are trying to build a community of people with sexual thoughts of children that are not ever going to harm a child. They vow their life so that you can come in there and you can have someone to talk to that can guide you. How can you live a better life and have these thoughts in your head and maybe work on living a more... Because if you can never act on your sexual preferences, then what kind of life is that? So you're going to have to guide them. Because if we follow the thought of killing every person that's a pedophile, they're going to go on the ground. Every single person, it'll be nobody. And for a person who actually goes out and abuses, it's so dangerous that you will have to kill the child because you're so afraid that someone's going to find out. It's going to be way more dangerous for children.
Yeah, like being gay in Russia.
Yeah, it's dangerous.
It's dangerous.
So this idea that we just kill everyone who has the sexual thought of children is not sustainable.
But where are we going to draw the line?
We are drawing the line. We're saying that you cannot have sexual interactions.
No, but I mean, 30 years ago, we said having sex with somebody with the same gender. Well, seriously, then you were breaching the law.
Yeah.
And then this has changed. And then sex with dead people, with animals.
Is that, that's illegal?
I have no idea.
Okay, I think sex with animals is illegal.
It's illegal, yeah. Yeah, I don't know about that. Because of the animal, because you hurt the animal. Yeah. And that doesn't make me angry at all. That just makes me sad.
We have a
I think about these people and I think, my God, poor people.
Yes.
But I mean, it doesn't make me angry. Yeah. Because, I mean, okay, if somebody rape a horse, what can I do? But with kids, it's totally different.
Yeah.
Then something happens in your head.
Yeah.
That's why this sexual abuse with children is making everybody angry.
I totally understand that. And, like, can you imagine? So the mother of one of these children, in this case you're talking about, she created Stina Sofia Stiftelse, and she is... That is a remarkable feat. You took something horrible that happened to you and you turned it into some way of helping others who've had this experience. But I have a totally new idea. I don't think that the people who are helping abuse survivors should work with prevention. I think those units should be completely separate, because prevention of any kind of trauma or violence in society is everybody's responsibility, not the victims. So it has become that these centers for abuse now also hold a heavy, heavy burden of working not only with helping people who have survived this trauma, but they're also having to work with creating ideas for prevention and talk to governments and try to fund money for making big new, health programs. But they should have... They should have a whole department that only works with prevention. That's how important it is. Any form of prevention that's going to make society heal should be everyone's job, not the victim's job.
And this relates to my main and last question, which is people who have experienced a trauma of this sort, what can they do? Yeah, they can go to their doctor and they could get therapy.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
And they're probably going to have to go to therapy in therapy for years and years and years and years. And then what is... and then you have all the voluntarily organizations in Norway. I can't remember the name of these.
You have NOK, which is the Center Against Abuse.
Exactly. What are they doing for people?
Well, they are having both groups, one-on-one conversations. They can help you with financial things. They can help you with pretty much everything. You have a place to go every
day.
Exactly. But there are very few when it comes... Norway's a big country.
And the question is, why aren't this a government job?
Yeah, and that's not even... They have to apply each year for money. And they might not even get their benefits from their community, kommune.
And this is ridiculous. Interesting, because I'm not the first guy screaming for money from the government. But I mean, people's mental health is one of the biggest costs we have in Norway.
Yes.
Last year, we have 61 billion kroners in what we call sykepenger, which is the money the businesses and the government have to pay for you being sick.
Yeah.
61 billion kroners.
Is that physical or mental or both?
It's both.
It's all of it, okay.
But the thing is, the biggest part of that is mental health.
Yeah.
And then there's the back issues and those stuff. But I mean, the biggest part
is mental issues. A lot of those things, I think, come from mental health too. Like, I had heavy back issues.
And the cost of this is just huge.
Yeah.
So it's very strange that they actually don't prioritize differently.
Well,
if we could help people with this kind of trauma, we would save society lots of money.
But I always ask the question a little differently. It's very strange that because it's we. I am society. It's me. What am I doing? It doesn't have to be, the biggest thing. You can find a cause to support. You could send a letter to a government official about your, you can post something on social media, you can do something, but to be honest, I feel damaged in many ways, but I feel damaged in the way that I talk about this so often with so many people that I think this is a part of normal discussions, and it's not. I don't think most people around the country are talking about sexual abuse and pedophiles and things that have happened
on a daily basis.
Yes,
no.
I think it's not. So
I don't think so.
We still have a way to go, but we're doing something, right? We're doing something. And I think it's going to change. The generation that grows up now is different than the previous. And I told you this earlier about how, you know, I told my mom how I feel about my childhood. She didn't tell her mom how she felt about her childhood. And her mom didn't tell her mom. So
have I told my mom?
Let's go in there a second. I just want to finish this point because no, they are the first generation, you could call the boomer generation, right? To hear from their children that you sucked as a mother or father. And my childhood was crap. I should speak for myself. For me, it's then easier when my child says to me, you suck as a mom. And I can say, first of all, it's not my fault because my childhood was shit. But then I can take the responsibility and say, I hear you. I'm going to do something about it. It, from what I experienced in your life, you're doing the same thing. You're trying to listen to your family and see what you can do to get better. So yeah, ask.
And definitely, our kids actually do this.
Yeah,
they tell.
Yeah, so
and
something is changing.
They don't wrap it in at all. Actually,
they don't sugarcoat
it. They don't sugarcoat it, which is okay. The question is, have I talked to my mom?
Yeah.
I can't. I don't know. I can't remember. And what would I talk to her about?
Don't you think you would have remembered if you did?
Yes, I probably would. But I am not sure what I would have talked to her about. I don't have anything undiscussed. I don't have anything unresolved. There is nothing she could do.
No.
There was nothing she could do. She was, and I don't know if she still are, but severely sick.
Yeah.
Mental health.
Yeah.
Which is, and what when I look around me, and I see this so much clearly today, when I meet people, you can see right away. I use the term when I can see the darkness in your eyes when I'm speaking to you. I can see that in a lot of people.
Yeah.
And when you see that, you need to make a choice. Because most people, I can't help most people.
Yeah.
I have enough helping myself and my family. I can't help other people. That would be impossible.
And you can't help anyone who doesn't ask for help, like we just said.
Exactly.
Earlier. Yeah.
Nobody can.
Yeah.
So, but this is, and you see this both in your private life and at work and with your friends.
Yeah.
You see things where you think, is that the way to solve this?
Yeah.
But and this is a very interesting question.
Yeah.
Should we be honest with our friends?
Yeah.
If your friends tell you a story.
Yeah.
About something in their family which is not good.
Yeah.
And you think that this is something, I mean, you have an idea what they should do, but you can't say it.
Yeah.
Because then you would hurt their feelings, or you would undermine their own mental state, or you would say things that you know they should probably have understood themselves. So it's like, this is very difficult. And one thing is with friends and what happens with friendships where you aren't honest about this.
I used to think that I would always be honest about everything. And now I don't do that anymore because I also think everyone's entitled to their own journey. So if a person has an issue that they don't talk about to you and you see it, but they don't tell you, then it's not your job to dig in. And I don't know, we're not going to go into this, but in your life, you had your issues. And I think I butted into your issues a lot. And I don't know if you noticed, but the last few weeks, there has been issues that I have not butted into at all. And that was hard for me. And I had to ask a friend who said to me, Tanya, is this your issue? No. Well, so why are you butting in? I'm okay, I'm not. Because it's not your issue. If people come talk to you about their issue, then you can say and be a part of it. But if they don't say anything and say, hey, we need your input here, I need you to talk to me about this, it's not your issue.
That's
so hard.
I really agree. And yeah, it's so hard.
It's so, I want to butt in. So my question, my thing is, if someone tells you, I have this issue, I think as a friend, you can say, listen, do you want to hear what I think? Or do you just want me to be a listening device? And they can choose. You know, I really want your input.
You said journey.
Yeah.
So where is this journey going?
That's a good question. And I did have a few other questions, but I think we're actually at a, I haven't looked at the time, but I think we can't,
I have no
we
idea
can't
what
be,
the time is.
We can meet again and talk, you know, but I think this is just the start of a journey of healing that I sometimes ask myself. Just yesterday, I said, why am I doing this? Who cares? Who wants to hear about this crap that I'm going through? Like, what does it matter to anyone? But then I thought, if I had heard something like this, someone talking about conflicts, we're going through these conflicts now, wouldn't you agree? We're not resolved. You and I aren't resolved.
Not at all.
We have lots of things that we've never discussed.
A lot of time.
Yeah. And I feel like we could just hear our mom walk up
yeah,
the
can
stairs.
You hear that?
Yeah. I don't know if it's going to come on the recording, but she's just walking up the stairs here. You said, should I talk to my mom? Who knows? That's your own journey. And you said people go to years and years and years of therapy. Maybe they don't. I think therapy today can be different. I think people who have experienced massive trauma, I say that I have experienced massive trauma. It's not up to me to define your trauma. I would, as a person on the outside, have my opinions on your trauma. But as someone who has experienced a lot of trauma, I would say it can go faster because it's very physical. If you work with some therapy that also is physical, not just talk.
Exactly. And we've talked about this. And yeah, that's why I asked about the journey.
And I think you could benefit from that too.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, and we've talked about trying this this drug.
Rachel Yehuda does this MDMA thing in New York. And we were talking about we should go there and we should have a film crew film our journey on this. You can have this 3-day therapy session that's 8 hours a day. That's massive. It scares me to death. Just
why does it
about
scare
it.
You?
Psychopharma scares me to death.
Okay, that doesn't scare me. You know what scares me? No. The reason I hesitate about this is totally different.
Oh, tell me.
And this is because what I think is extremely difficult to think about is there's one thing I would never do in my life, and that's putting up a video camera and filming me while I was sleeping. So for me, being filmed while I'm under drug, that would be, I don't think I could watch it.
Can I tell you, I don't think I would do that. I think that we would film the journey going there and we would film us going into session and maybe coming out. We wouldn't film anything that happens inside a session.
Thank you. That's relieving because
I think
then
would
I wouldn't have
session.
A problem with it. Yeah,
yeah, I
because
think it would
filming
disturb
that
it.
Would be just, I no. could not. Look at that. Afterwards.
You know, you film and interview the people who are running this program. What does it do for people? What's the benefit? So basically, this is a program that helps you supposedly relieve trauma much quicker than just talking, because you really immerse yourself in like psychopharma. What is it? Drops that are based. They're not supposed to make you into like a crazy hallucination, but you can go and open up into your inner feelings quicker. Because obviously, when we started this talk today, I was very nervous. Now I feel much more relaxed. But it would be interesting to have this box, you know, like I told you, to show.
Yeah, to see your emotional level.
And see, like, I wonder,
yeah,
it would be
that.
Red for a long time and then slowly taper
You have
down.
Ordered that box now?
Yes, I have. I don't know
they if think you're a therapist.
I think they think I'm a therapist. Yeah. And it didn't say anywhere that I had to be a therapist, but I hope I get it.
But there are companies in Norway that think I'm an electrician. So I don't think that's important. Yeah.
Let's blank that out. No, I'm just But you said this journey, and I wanted to go back to that because we don't know where this is going, but I'm very grateful that you want to be part of this. And I don't know where this podcast is going. It started with me and my daughter, and now it's you. And I want to take it, like, first we take the familiar, like, the family setting, and then I want to branch out to what can you do for help and what can explain some of these things. Like, what are the scientific explanations? Because what also has helped me get better is understanding that there is a very factual physical reaction happening in my body that I couldn't have helped as a child. So what happened to me triggered a lot of, like, say, the neocortex didn't develop properly, and the neocortex is helping us regulate our emotions. So since there were no adults around to show me how to regulate my own emotions in a healthy way, I never learned that. So now I have to rewire neurons in my brain to create new pathways so that I can function and communicate, like with you, in a more healthy manner.
But
than
do you think we really can
learn?
I don't think we can change. But what we can do is we can have it on the top of our mind all the time. So it's you're conscious about it, but I'm not so sure if you can actually change. Because, I mean, imagine, and this is something I would never believe I would say a couple of years ago. If I go back and look at the way we learned to handle conflicts and the way we learned, I mean, this is something I'm sorry, I don't think you can relearn it. It's too late. Maybe you could have done it if you got help when you were like 10, 15. But when you're 50, then the only thing you can do is just to be conscious about how you are behaving and continuously think about that and say, I know I shouldn't respond like this. That's why I shouldn't respond like this. So you have to make a concrete decision every time you want to respond in the way you learn as a kid. That's what I believe. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's possible to change it. That's why we need to try this drug thing.
So an observation is that, to me, it's fascinating that you're sitting in the midst of change, after change, talking about how you can't change while you already changed.
Yeah, but I haven't changed.
You have changed.
No, I'm just conscious about it.
You and I are having a very, I would say, mature conversation about stuff that has happened to us in a very civilized manner, in a loving manner, in a caring manner, and in a curious manner, which could not have happened at all 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Not at all. Not a chance.
Isn't that because we have changed? No.
That's changed.
It's just because I'm conscious about it all the time.
That's what change is. You can be conscious. You couldn't be conscious
before. Okay, if that's
before.
What change is, then I agree. Yeah.
Thank
because
you.
In my mind, change is something happens when your neurons connect in a different way.
So they already have.
Do you think so?
Of course. How could you react like this and not like the old patterns? How could you react in new patterns if you haven't changed? So the question to me is, or to you, I mean, is what does change look like? Because it sounds like to you, you have an idea of change and it's not this. So what is it? Who are you when you have changed? If you could change, you don't believe in change, but if you could have changed,
then I would do all the things I do now unconscious. It would just happen because it's a natural part of my behavior. Now it's not. Being nice is not a natural part of my behavior.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's not. I have to train on this every day. The natural part of my behavior is being angry.
Yeah, mine too.
And it's being responsive in a negative way.
Yeah.
If somebody comes to me and wants something,
yeah,
whether it's in the office or it's in the family, my instant unconscious reaction is no.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. That's why I need to stop.
Yeah.
Pull back. Breathe. Just 2 seconds. Breathe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Oh my God.
I would like to hear more about that.
But
do I mean it? Probably not. But I have to do that because I have to be a grown up.
But you say you need it, but does it change? I would say you need it because it changes your life in so many ways. When you actually take that time to listen to someone else, you get a better life because your social interactions with other people are better, which leaves your nervous system in a more calm state, which is better for you. So then I want to ask you, we're sitting here talking about similarities because that's very similar to me. And I don't think you know this about me. or maybe you do, but that I'm also just like that, very negative. In my interactions in this household, my first thought is always negative, picking and plucking. I don't know if you do that, but you just say no, maybe, but I actually actively pick. And
of course,
like
I do.
My husband, I pick on him all the time. Like, I have to, he actually said something yesterday that, you know, this is just like, it's overwhelming. And I'm like, wow, you're actually right. I can see that. I'm, from the minute you come in the door, I'm like, ice picking away at you. So,
but what they don't know, yeah. And this is interesting, what they don't know about you, and I don't know, is all the times you actually try to not pick.
Yeah.
And so in a regular day,
that's a good point.
If, yeah, in a regular day, you would probably try to be nice 70, 80, 90% of the time. Yeah. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So the 10 to 20 to 30% of the times, I'm not being nice, picking and saying no.
Yeah.
Like the other day when, this is a very interesting story actually, because my wife, she was going to a party and she took a bottle of liquor, gin.
Yeah.
She took my most important gin bottle in the world.
This is a big no-no.
This is a big no-no. You can't do that to
that's
a person.
That's my alcohol. It's my drug.
It's my alcohol.
It's my happy pill. It's my Prozac.
And of course I know I shouldn't react and say no.
Yeah.
Still I did. And but the same day, I probably had 90 times where I didn't.
Yeah.
And that's why people around you would never know how much time you actually spend trying to change. And that's the most annoying part of change, because nobody understands it. You're working with yourself inside your head continuously, 24 hours a day, and you're really trying to change.
Yeah.
And people say, you're the same way you were 10 years ago. People say that.
And families are the worst, right? Because in a way, we want everyone else to hold status quo. We want everyone to stay the same. Because when another person in our family changes, that means I have to look at myself, that how am I changing? So I totally understand where you're coming from. But you know what's most interesting about that is that you're still saying that you're not changing, but that is such a huge change to hear somebody sit there and say, I work all the time, all day long, to be conscious. And I have 70, 80, 90% that I want to be mad, but I'm not. And I'm working on holding it and interacting better. That is amazing. And that is change. I think that's shocking almost.
Interesting that you call it. To me, that's not change. That's just... Yeah.
To me, that is what change is. Because it's working. It's not because it's not the result. This is what I'm trying to remind myself of. Yesterday, I was feeling really bummed out. And I was like, what am I doing this for? It's so dumb. I'm wasting my time. Nobody cares about this stuff. And I thought to myself, I'm so result-oriented. That's why I liked sales, because it was a yes or a no. As soon as you force, I could force a no from a client sometimes just because I wanted to move on. I don't want to wait. Like, come on, result. So when I don't have results and I'm sitting working on projects that take a long time, nitpicking and, you know, really just trying to make something work technically, then I feel like I'm not doing anything. I'm not producing anything. So when I'm not producing, I'm not good enough. So for me, change is telling myself every day, I've done enough. I have enough. I am enough.
But is anyone telling you that you have changed? Because I need
a
to...
A few people.
I hope my kids are going to listen to this, because I'm going to ask them this. Have I changed? I'm not so sure if they can see it. Maybe they would say, well, we don't see you that often because we have moved away from home. So, yeah. But I mean, can they see this? I don't know. And I have no idea. So that's going to be a very interesting discussion. I don't think I can be sober through that discussion.
But I think it doesn't. That's the point for me. It doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. And that's very difficult because I do care a lot what other people think. But
you care what your kid thinks.
Yeah, but I care
because
how
that's
it feels.
The thing. Yeah, okay.
So if we went to Japan and we didn't fight that much, to me, that is a big change. We resolved every conflict good because we have very different things we like to do on holiday. And we had to communicate and be compromise.
Oh my, yeah, that's a horrifying word. Yeah, I don't like that
word.
So
I have to compromise to make it work. And she has to compromise to make it work. And when that came out, good, then to me, that is what change is.
But
it's
you
not
have
a goal
to remember that,
then you're dead.
One of the reasons that we are probably not that good at compromising is not just our childhood, but it's because we both live in a way, work-wise, where we decide ourselves 100% what we could do, what we want to do. Like, I mean, the head of the board in the company I spend the most time, he told me that, Frode, you could never be hired by anyone. That would be impossible. Mm-hmm. You are uncontrollable, which means that I make my own decisions every day. That's why compromising is difficult, I think.
Yeah.
Because I hate compromising. I say yes or no. This is how it's going to be. So for me to compromise, especially at work, is extremely difficult. Because I always think and believe I know the solution.
Yeah.
But which I means think that I'm compromising on this is extremely difficult. And I don't think that's just upbringing. I think that's the way we'll live.
Yeah. And it's like... I've had, you know, some issues with friends I told you about lately, and it's very hard. I have to look at myself and say, okay, even if I don't agree with the outcome of the situation, I can't control it, but I also need to look at myself. What have I done to end up in this situation? And what is it that I can do differently another time to not keep ending up in this situation? What is it say about my actions, and where am I not listening? Where am I not? So I think when you say change, for me, when things, I'm not saying life will never run smoothly. It will always challenge you in some way. The minute you sit down and you go, oh, everything's great, I've solved everything, bam, you're going to get something hit really hard in your head from somewhere, a physical thing or a mental thing or somewhere in your life, because you to accept that life is changed.
Have you noticed when you read the paper or you look at, people being interviewed on TV telling about, they're telling a story and they're saying, I was so tired. My life was so horrible. I was so far down. Now everything is okay.
Yeah.
I feel good now.
Yeah.
I really don't believe them. I never believe them.
Yeah. It's like anyone who died. You know, oh, they were such a great person. And I'm like, why can't people just tell the real story? Like, you know what? This person was great, but they also were sad or had some hard times. You know, like our mom's funeral is going to be interesting. We should maybe talk about that. Hopefully it's a long time for now because I'm actually enjoying hanging out with her.
But we're going to talk about her funeral? That's a bit early.
I talked to my mom about her funeral all the time. And that's not good for her. And I feel like...
I agree, that's not good. And especially if you're going to decide the music and what we're going to eat afterwards. We're going to have cake. And we are going to have smørbrød.
Do you remember when we were kids?
We're going to have smørgåsbord.
We had these little sandwiches.
Oh, yeah. And with salmon and shrimps and roast beef.
And my brother and I, we would love funerals in the family. Because there would be some older person that we didn't really know that well. Because our family is not very... big, and most of these people were a little bit way out of our normal or our day-to-day life, so we weren't that sad about it, but we would wait until they said yes, and we would take big plates from the kitchen. Like, everybody had these small plates, you know, like fancy small plates where you put one or two small, very small sandwiches on, and we would go to the kitchen, get these dinner plates, and we would shuffle the stuff on.
I'm going to tell you a secret.
And hide away and eat.
I still go to funerals. You know that, with my mom.
We just
what
did.
Do you think I did? What do you think I do there?
And we ate a ton.
I eat.
I remember. So I feel like we're kind of now circling a little bit because I'm enjoying myself and I don't want to end the conversation. But it's been, I think, I don't know what to time it, but I think it's been a long...
I think it's about time to end this part of the conversation.
And I have other questions for another time, but... Yeah, thank you for doing this with me. This was very great. And our moms now... Oh, no.
It's the cat.
No, that's
she's
my
going
brother.
Up and down with
that's
the cat.
Our brother. I said my
is that
brother.
Our brother?
Because he's walking too fast. Our mom doesn't walk
that's
that
true.
Fast.
That's true.
So our brother used to live in this house too, and now he's moving out. So it's just, we've all lived here at some point, except for in our childhood.
It's a family house.
Everyone's been in and out of this house for in stages. But thank you, Frode. I hope you had a good time.
Thank you for having me. It's been kind of...
How was it for you?
I don't know. I think it was. It's actually very different than I thought it was going to be.
Oh.
Very different. We can talk about the next time.
Okay, next time. One last question is, if you wanted to say to someone, how can they, like we've been talking about, we're siblings, we've been talking about how we can heal our family dynamics. That's why I'm here. I'm thinking that's why you're here. And share with others our journey. So what is something you would say to someone else that wants to start that journey in their family but don't know how to do it? They have a sibling they don't talk to that much anymore. Is there something you would say?
I hear about that a lot. I know a lot of people who doesn't have contact with their siblings.
Is there something they can do?
No, because okay, it takes two to tango.
Yeah.
Which means that both parties need to want to talk to each other.
Yeah.
And this has taken us, 25 years together? 30 years? I don't know.
Or 50. A long time.
So that means you can ask for...
Invite,
please, can we sit down? I have something I need to talk to you about.
Or maybe but I want to listen. Because that's what you said earlier. Listening has been key change for you.
Yeah. So if you can try... But it needs to be both people or else nothing is going to happen.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
True.
That was the non-positive ending of this discussion.
I don't think that's negative because there might be a person out there listening thinking it's the other person's fault. And you got to know it's both of you.
But your reactions is always your fault.
Yeah.
So
that's true. It's your responsibility, I wouldn't say. It's not your fault.
I agree.
It's your responsibility. Because, you know, leaving fault out of it lifts a burden, I feel, in your shoulder. It's not my fault, but it's my responsibility to fix it.
So let's end on that note.
Okay.
Responsibility.
Thank you, Frodo.
High five.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Please share your comments or questions with us at spirals@unicornvoice.com. And to learn more about trauma, go to unicornvoice.com. Now you get to listen to some of my original songs or weird demos. Do all kinds of bad things to him. Like a little voodoo doll, I'll squeeze him tied up to the wall. 'Cause there ain't nothing worse you can do. That's innocent and true. There ain't no more pain in my heart. Still I feel you tearing me apart. You stole my dream and you took my life away. You stole my dream and you took my touching felt so good. Is that because you never understood that this tiny face, it was made for hope. This heart was not meant to cope.
it's the only way I see that I can live. Since you stole my dreams and you took my life from me. You stole my dreams and you stole my dreams from me. Is this abuse? It's not enough. People tell me to be quiet and be tough. Why are they ashamed? I'm the one who served. I didn't do nothing wrong. Still my